All right. Well, good evening. Thank you for being here. I am looking forward to this evening a lot, maybe specifically about an hour from now. But I'm looking forward to spending some time together thinking about business as mission. Most of us spend the majority of our time, or at least a very significant portion of our time that we are not sleeping, working. And we all have different jobs, we do different things, we bring different approaches and philosophies to that. Tonight I want to spend a little bit of time looking at some of what I think are right ways to think about business as mission. Now, I'm a little nervous about this evening for several reasons. One is, I didn't spend a lot of time looking, but I think I'm one of the youngest self-employed people here. And so it feels very much to me like there are far more qualified individuals. So I'll try to get over that and try to say without apology what I believe. And if you will hang on for the ride and listen to my wild idealistic ideas, I will be more than happy to hear your more seasoned rebuttals. Another reason I am a little nervous about this evening is because I work pretty closely with some of you, and I can sort of picture you snorting as I hold forth about my ideals that you don't necessarily see, you know, working out in daily life. So I recognize that there is that aspect to life, that we have our ideals, we work toward those ideals, and sometimes we do better than others at meeting them. So all of those disclaimers aside, I am excited about this evening because I do feel very strongly about business as mission. I've known since I was, I don't know when, very young, that being a business person or being in business is what I was going to do with my life. I think the first thing, the first business venture that I started with the help of my very patient mother was when I was 12 years old, and a number of your wives and you got in your church mailboxes order slips for onion plants that I ordered in because I was irritated that Stutzman's Greenhouse would not hire me, and so I decided that I would run competition. So I ordered in onion plants by the case and sold them to church ladies. It was not a particularly profitable venture, but it was really, I enjoyed it, and it was good practice. I've tried a number of things since then. When I was 14 and my brother Grant was 12, during the school year, during the winter on Saturdays, we would get up at 6:30, and go cut firewood. We would usually cut part of the day, deliver, and sell part of the day. Again, not a tremendously profitable venture, but a very instructive one. I learned a lot of things about work. I learned a lot of things about sales. I learned a lot of things about people and working with them. Overall, it was a very good experience. One of the key things about business, we hope, is that it actually pays our bills. And none of those things actually did that for me. When Dorcas and I were volunteering for Choice Books in Colorado in 2009 and 10, I was not self-employed and we were not making a lot of money, but it gave me some time to think about some of these things. And during that time, I did a fair bit of reading, as well as two exercises that I come back to frequently as I go through life, especially as I evaluate my business life. I wrote two things. One was a personal mission statement, kind of detailing what I wanted to be about. And the way I formatted my personal mission statement, my mission is to know and love God and to live, relate, and do business as his hands and feet on earth. And I broke it down into some of the key areas that I thought I would have influence there. One is a child of God, one is a husband and a father, one is a friend, and the fourth is a business person. So I wrote my personal mission statement. I also wrote my obituary. And it was an interesting exercise because my mission statement helped define what I wanted my life to be about. And the obituary was a bit of a look back, saying what I hope people can have said about the life that I lived. So I just want to excerpt a few things that I wrote there to give you a little bit of a picture of the lens that I see life and business through. From my mission statement, I am a businessman and I know I am living like Christ in that role when I am uncompromisingly honest in everything I do, caring more about the people than the bottom line, giving every task my absolute best, and enthusiastic when doing my job. Those were some of the key measures that I wanted to, that I used as my markers to see whether I was being successful in living that part of my mission. The last sentence of my conclusion, I am successful in business when it is operating profitably and my colleagues are happy and know I care more about them than I do about their contribution to the bottom line. That was my mission statement. That's what I hope to live. Now, what I hope, and you know, nobody is obligated to use this if and when I do pass away. But this is the gist of what I hope people can say about the life I lived. Shane, and I'll jump around a little bit here. Shane was both well-known and well-liked in the community and by the neighbors, friends, and business associates that he knew and cared about. He strove to live and do business so that no one could say they had been mistreated by him. Where he failed, he did everything he could do to make amends for his wrongs. More than that, he cared about his friends and colleagues' spiritual, emotional, physical, and social well-being, and used his time, money, and influence to better the lives of the people around him. Through his generous giving, he also impacted the lives of countless people he never met and improved their lives on both physical and spiritual levels. Jumping down a little bit, lending a listening ear, bandaging a wound, writing contracts, buying and selling, giving sacrificially, investing time in people, and loving his family were all ways that Shane lived his ultimate goal, to love the Lord Jesus Christ and live like him by loving those around him like Jesus would. You know, it sounds pretty good on paper. The problem is there's a lot of real life that happens between sitting down and saying what you want to be about and looking, or having other people looking back and saying what you actually were about. And you all know that when somebody dies, in a very, very short amount of time, you can boil down with crystalline clarity what they were actually about. So what we want to talk about is some of the real life that happens in the middle there. Like I said, when we were volunteering here, it was very clear to me that at some point, being in business is what I wanted to be doing. My primary vision was to make lots of money so that I could give lots of money. I enjoy business. I'm interested in it. I think at some level, I am gifted for it. And so it seemed very natural that I would use those strengths to make money to help other people. Well, those issues got a little cloudier when I started seeing some of the problems with a lot of Western mission work where we tend to throw money at stuff, and sometimes it really doesn't work that well. You know, we try to help people. We go into areas with the purest of intentions and ignorantly blunder our way around and really sometimes do more damage with our money than we help. Well, that kind of clouded things. Well, you know, so if God doesn't actually need my money to do some of those things, you know, what is the driving purpose here? There are several, I've reached several conclusions. One is that we should give generously because there are many, many ways that the church and people and God can use money to further his kingdom. The other thing that I realized is that if the primary purpose of profitability in business is not to just throw more money at mission efforts, it is absolutely crucial that we are missionaries in the marketplace. I want to read a little bit I want to talk a little bit about a mission business that I have the privilege of helping to lead. And most of you are familiar with it in various, or to differing levels. But I serve on both the local and the national Choice Books boards of directors. And it's an interesting ministry that has really grown on me. It's not a particularly glamorous one. Simply taking a snapshot view, it looks like a relatively profitable one. But there's an awful lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes, both financially and personally, that I find really interesting. Let me read you Choice Books' mission statement. To share the good news of Jesus Christ in the general marketplace through inspiring and wholesome reading material. Now, that mission in the marketplace has allowed Choice Books to minister to many people that would never step foot inside a church, inside a Christian bookstore, really inside most Christian places. We hear story after story after story of people sometimes in really dire need picking up a book off of a display that has made a profound impact on their life. One of the stories that really sticks with me, and Choice Books services displays in quite a wide variety of places. Drugstores, military posts, Walmarts, grocery stores, you name it. But a CVS in Southern California had a display one time that a young man was checking out, walked past the display, saw a book that caught his attention, picked up the book, put the wide concoction of drugs that he had purchased, or that he was going to purchase, to kill himself, back on the shelf, and went home and read the book. You know, those kinds of letters, when they send them to central office, do something. He was there getting the stuff he needed to kill himself, and he was not on his way to a church. By being in the marketplace, we were in a position that we could reach people. Every year for the last several years, and this year looks like it is on track again, Choice Books nationwide has sold around 50 million dollars in retail sales of books. Now, those are the retail prices rather than the wholesale, which is what we do most of our work with. Yet, because we operate on slim margins, even though, to me, that is a ginormous number, we operate on slim margins, and some of the executive leadership at the national level has rejected pay raises that we as a board tried to give them. These people feel very strongly that they are in business as mission. They didn't feel like, from a financial perspective, the organization could afford it, and they didn't need it, and they wanted the ministry to continue. On more local levels, without the subsidization of church offerings like we've had in the past, if we don't run a good business, we don't have a mission. Our mission, however, nuances how we make our business decisions. I've wrestled with this as we look at servicing unprofitable accounts, for instance. You know, we often talk about the balance of business and mission. You know, how do you find that right balance? And I have come to dislike that analogy. I think that rather than a scales, we need to picture a blending, that we have to make smart business decisions, but it has to be about more than the bottom line. I was going to introduce my books. Some of the books that I am pulling from this evening, I haven't read all of them very, very carefully. I've just pulled some of the nuggets from them. First one, You Don't Need a Title to Be a Leader by Mark Sanborn. Anointed for Business by Ed Silvoso. John Maxwell, There's No Such Thing as Business Ethics. And probably my favorite business book of all time, Good to Great by Jim Collins. There's no such thing as business ethics. And you would be surprised at how many people that surprises. The whole thesis of Maxwell's book here is, you know, it's pretty easy. You treat people the way you want to be treated. And we all understand that, and it's pretty basic stuff. But when the chips are down, it sometimes becomes a little more difficult to actually put that into action. George Barna, the well-known pollster, asked people whether they had complete confidence that leaders from various professions would consistently make job-related decisions that were morally appropriate. The results were abysmal. 3% of the population thought that executives of large corporations were trustworthy. 3% thought elected government officials were trustworthy. 5% thought news reporters and journalists were trustworthy. 8%, and small business owners really took a step up here, 8% thought that as small business owners. Ministers, priests, and clergy came in at an astounding 11%, and teachers came in at 14%. Now, I think there probably was a question with the way there was a problem with the way the question is phrased, because there are very few people, it's pretty absolute. If you are trusting that somebody would consistently make job-related decisions that were morally appropriate, that's a pretty high bar. But those are some terrible numbers. Maxwell says that our abysmal state of ethics results from three bad decisions. One, we do what's most convenient. Two, we do what we must to win. And three, we rationalize our choices with relativism. We do what is most convenient. That, you know, we get that. That it's pretty easy to do the easy thing. We do what we must to win. And there's an interesting story here that I want to just excerpt. The Atlanta Business Chronicle reports that a group of executives came together recently at a leading company in Atlanta to brainstorm ideas for a 3-day national conference to be attended by several thousand sales employees. As the team shared ideas for different sessions, a senior vice president of the corporation enthusiastically suggested, "Why don't we do a piece on ethics?" It was as if someone had died. The room went silent. An awkward moment later, the discussion continued as if the vice president had never uttered a word. She was so taken aback by everyone's reaction, she simply let the idea drop. Later that day, she happened to run into the company's CEO. She recounted to him her belief that the subject of ethics should be addressed at the conference. She expected him to agree wholeheartedly. Instead, he replied, "I'm sure everyone agrees that's an important issue. But there's a time and a place for everything. The sales meeting is supposed to be upbeat and motivational, and ethics is such a negative subject." We rationalize our choices with relativism. Let's see if I can find the... Here we go. A course entitled "The Ethics of Corporate Management," offered at the University of Michigan, says in its description, "This course is not concerned with the personal moral issues of honesty and truthfulness. It is assumed that the students at this university have already formed their own standards on these issues." Wow. We tend to be very easy on ourselves, judging ourselves according to our good intentions. while holding others to a higher standard and judging them by their worst actions. You do it, I do it. In the business world, it's pretty easy to read into, you know, every little thing that happens, and assume the worst about other people involved. You know, I do this at home. When I tell my kids to do something, I expect them to do it. You know, when my wife asks me to take out the garbage, I plan to get to it at some point, but it typically is not, you know, something I jump up to do right away. You know, I see what my children are doing. I know what my intentions are, and I respond accordingly. So, the marketplace without mission can be a pretty miserable place. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what mission in the marketplace can look like. Compare the ethics of corporate management and the assumption that students at this university have already formed their own standards on these issues with the core values of a local company that I won't name so Sturdy Built doesn't get, you know, brought into the conversation here, and their core values and what they stand for. Their core values that they tell people freely are bringing glory to God in all we do by operating the company in a manner consistent with Bible principles, living by the golden rule, which means we treat our customers and employees like we would like to be treated. Therefore, whatever you want others to do to you, do also to them, Matthew 7:12. Building trust and being honest are central to creating respect and integrity. Offering our customers exceptional selection and value by utilizing durable materials and careful craftsmanship. Treating our customers as crucial to the success of our business. Without them, we would not be in business. Serving our employees and their families by establishing a work environment and company policies that build character, strengthen individuals, and nurture families. Employees are our most valuable asset. Providing a return on the family's investment, sharing the Lord's blessing with our employees, and investing in our community. Now, doesn't that sound like somebody that you would like to work for or that you would like to do business with? And, you know, it's interesting that we, as I think about blending and seeing as one mission and business, many, many times biblical principles lead to successful businesses. That is not always the case. Sometimes taking stands for biblical principles can be very harmful to a business. So we don't do these things because we hope to be successful by living out what the Bible tells us. We do them because it's the right thing to do. Most times, people notice and appreciate that commitment to truth, integrity, and quality. I want to talk a little bit about prophets with purpose. One of the things that I think we often wrestle with is this the dichotomy between, or the false dichotomy, I think, between full-time mission and working. You know, and we often hear and say things like, you know, you do your ministry in the evenings, after you get off work. You know, and there are varying iterations of that. Sometimes, you know, we talk in years or months or whatever, but frequently we talk about mission and work as being two entirely different things. One of the things that causes problems for Christians when we think about these things is that the scripture is very clear that the love of money is a dangerous thing. And so it is, we see it as being inherently risky, and it is, to spend lives in pursuit of profits. And we tend to think it is inherently better to spend our lives doing things that we don't even pretend to try to make profits doing. I think we wrestle with some of those things, and I've wrestled with some of these things. If we're honest with interpreting Scripture, we recognize that it does have lots to say about the danger of riches. It also has a lot to say about using what we have been given to our maximum effectiveness. And I want to talk about two different, what's the word I'm looking for? Two different approaches to the recognition that riches are dangerous. I have a friend or an acquaintance. I don't know the person well. But we were talking one time about the danger of riches and the danger of being too comfortable in our world. And he is a part of a fellowship that is very concerned about the temptation of riches. And they have agreed that nobody in their congregation will make more than a certain amount of money. If they are offered raises above that cap, then they will turn them down. And their way of trying to avoid the temptation of riches is to simply not have them. And I respect the intentions, but when we were talking, something just seemed really strange about that approach. And I came across a story, it's been years ago, and I have spent the last number of years looking for it again, and finally this morning I found it. I want to tell you a little bit about Barnhart, Crane, and Rigging. Barnhart, Crane, and Rigging is a Memphis, Tennessee-based crane company that began in 1986, the year that I was born, when a 25-year-old man named Alan Barnhart and his brother Eric went into business together. I want to back into this and read to you their purpose and mission statement, as well as one of their core values. Their purpose statement reads like this. The purpose of Barnhart Crane and Rigging Company is to glorify God by providing an opportunity for his people to use their skills and gifts in his service through constructive work, personal witness, and ministry funding. Their mission statement is, Barnhart will continuously improve and grow to be the best heavy lift and heavy transport company. And they've done some incredibly ingenious things with moving just obscenely huge objects that were real works of engineering to figure out how they were going to move this stuff. One of their core values, and their core values, I'll just hit them and go into detail with the last one, safety, quality service, innovation, continuous improvement, fairness, and the one that I want to focus on, profit with a purpose. We will attempt to make profit and will invest the profit to expand the company and to meet the needs of people, physically, mentally, and spiritually. Now, that sounds good. And most of us, you know, think about doing those things. Now I want you, as I talk about this a little bit more, think about the difference in approach between capping your salary and never making more than a certain amount to the approach that these folks took. In 1986, Alan Barnhart was 25 and planning to go into business with his brother. An evangelical Christian, he wondered what Scripture had to say about the profits he hoped to make. So he combed the Bible for whatever advice it had to offer about money. That's when he came across verses like this. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. No matter where he turned, it seemed to him that Scripture was sending a very clear warning. Money can be dangerous. I read all these verses and I thought, man, I want to be good in business and I'm competitive, Barnhart says, but I didn't want to make a lot of money if doing so would damage my life. And I could really see where it could. So Alan and his brother Eric decided to do something unusual. They vowed to cap their income. That sounds familiar. Earning no more than the middle class members of their Memphis, Tennessee Sunday school class, and give much of their company's profits to charity. In the first year of business, they gave away $50,000, more than Allen's salary. Now, nearly 30 years later, the results are even more tremendous. The Barnharts have adjusted their wage according to inflation, but basically stayed at the, you know, the middle class wage that they started at. The Barnharts oversee a $250 million crane and rigging company, and they've donated nearly $100 million of its profits to charity. Moreover, in 2007, they decided to go even further. They gave the entire company away. Though they still run its daily operations, the National Christian Foundation now owns Barnhart Crane and Rigging. The brothers will never reap its accrued value because they kept none of it. Now, I'm not saying that we should all do this, but I want you to compare those two approaches. One is simply staying as far away from any temptation as possible. The other says we're going to do this the best we know how, but we still want to stay away from those temptations. I've spent a fair bit of time thinking about business's mission. When I started thinking about this evening, I realized that I had a clear idea of what business's mission looks like for our company, but I wasn't quite sure how all of those things translated to some of your industries, because we work in a very we see a lot of people, we work with some kind of interesting and difficult situations. And so I had a bit of a hard time zooming back out and putting my finger on what all of the principles that apply to everybody, what some of those things are. So I decided that we'd certainly want to get there, but I'd like to spend just a little bit of time so you understand the lens through which I see these issues. I'd like to just talk a little bit about, you know, the way we approach some of the decisions that we make. One of the things we try to do is be the business we want to be from the very beginning. Like any other business, we have good times and bad times. We have tried to, in cases of bad surprises on bids or customer dissatisfaction and those kinds of things, we've tried to resolve those situations as if we wouldn't miss the money. And sometimes, you know, when we're trying to figure out how to pay the electrical bill, that's kind of difficult. And we aren't making a lot of money. But it's not really our client's fault that we aren't making money, or we aren't making lots of money. We try to treat people fairly, kind of regardless how it feels. One of the core values that we have is we try to treat people as more than contributions to the bottom line. And we work with kind of three different sets of people that we get to try to figure out, you know, what exactly this looks like. First of all, we have our team that are pretty crucial to that bottom line. We try to value them for people and for their contribution for more than just the bottom line. We also have our investors who are pretty key to actually allowing us to keep working. We have our tenants who pay rent, and if they aren't there, then the whole mess kind of falls apart too. And so we have all of these people with differing goals and differing philosophies that we try to find the win for everybody. As most of you know, sometimes that's easier than others. As investment managers, it would be tempting to try to sell houses to people that are not in their best interest to purchase, simply because it would really be nice to add some more houses to our portfolio so we could bill out more fees. Long term, however, if it's not a good deal for the person buying, it's not a good deal for us. You know, it has to be a win for everybody or it doesn't work. On the tenant side, you know, anywhere you have people, you have issues. And we work with occasionally at least, kind of a different group of people. Over the last years, we've helped provide counseling and referral services to people better equipped than we are for our tenants who are struggling financially and personally. Most of the time, what we find is that the financial issues and the rent not being paid is simply the end symptom of dysfunction in other areas of life. If we can, and I see this over and over and over, how bad training, bad relationships, you know, bad stuff just causes a lot of problems. If we can help bring peace and stability to the root issues, they will have better lives and we are more likely to get our rent paid. Another thing that we try to see as we go about our business is that the right people are our most valuable asset. And this principle comes from Good to Great, where Collins talks about getting the right people on the bus, getting them in the right seats on the bus. And those are two different things. Probably we've all seen a group of fantastic people who just don't quite click. With a little bit of shuffling of roles and changing of responsibilities, that same group of people can turn out an entirely different set of results. We all have different strengths and weaknesses. We try to develop the strengths and delegate the weaknesses. People operating in their sweet spot are far more fulfilled and energetic in doing their job. If somebody is naturally gifted or trained for a particular task, doing high-quality work quickly comes naturally and is more fulfilling. And I just want to pick on a few of the people that we work with and just kind of use them as examples. In July of last year, I turned over all of the maintenance and remodel coordination to Brian, and I cannot tell you how much happier we all are. You know, I kind of thought it was something I probably should be doing, and I realized I'm really bad at it. You know, over and over, I'd send people to a job and forget, you know, I had forgotten to tell them to pick something up from the farm that they were supposed to have. We'd waste time, we'd waste money, driving after something that should have been there to start with. I'd make stuff up at the beginning of the day trying to figure out, you know, where people were going and what they were supposed to be doing, and it didn't work. You know, Brian actually kind of enjoys those details, and he is a fantastic coordinator. I don't have to do it, and I don't have to feel guilty about not doing it because I was really bad at it anyway. Janet, who is our legal officer, has spent most of her career as a company lawyer for a variety of corporations. And she has an incredible capacity to read through page after page after page of mind-numbingly boring stuff and make sense of it. I will sometimes throw a 30-page document on her desk and, you know, ask her to tell me what I need to know about it. You know, when I look at those documents, I kind of flip through and, oh, well, that's kind of an interesting section, and I keep flipping. And I get through a 30-page document, you know, pretty quickly. After quite a while sometimes, she will hand back that 30-page document with the important sections highlighted. And she's fantastic with with writing our contracts and agreements to say concisely and clearly what we need to have said. She has the training, yes, but she has the natural interest and ability in focusing on that detail. You know, it works a lot better if Janet is our legal department than if I am the legal department. Nathan in the accounting is sort of the same way. I want good reports. I like reports for the stories that they tell, and I don't like putting the numbers in to get the stories. And Nathan's actually pretty good at that. And, you know, it just works better when we are doing the things that we're good at doing. I often tell my wife when I come home, the more people I get to work with and the more people I work with that are good at what they do, I come home and I say, you know, I think the main thing that I bring to this organization is I was dumb enough to start it. Because everybody that I work with is better at what they do than I am. But, you know, that's good. And it is important to let people work in their strengths. We go to work. One of the reasons is to pull a paycheck. And that's kind of a necessary thing. Mountains of research shows that to the right people, money is one of the least effective tools for motivation. And I just want to pull a few interesting little excerpts out just because it's fun. Nucor Steel is one of my favorite examples of an organization that has built a ridiculously strong and passionate corporate culture. Nucor Steel began in the 80s when steel imports were a big thing, and a lot of American steelmakers were saying, you know, that's all this imported steel is so cheap, you know. Bethlehem Steel, one of the chief competitors, the CEO stood up at a conference of steelworkers and he said, the first, second, and third problems with American steel is imports. Ken Iverson, who was the CEO of Nucor, said, this is awesome. You know, steel is heavy, and they have to ship that stuff all the way from China to get it here. There has to be a way we can be more efficient than that. Nucor left all of the traditional steel areas and started building mini steel mills in farm country. They said, you can teach a farmer how to roll steel, but you cannot teach a farmer's work ethic to somebody that doesn't have it. They built, and when I say ridiculously passionate corporate culture, what I'm trying to say is ridiculously passionate. Their employees would show up 30 minutes early for their shift. They would line up their tools so that when the starting gun fired, they were ready to go. And they got a lot of work done. In the steel industry, which is a very highly unionized field, Nucor executives had to protect union representatives from their employees when they came to try to organize them. They literally were throwing rocks at the union organizers because they didn't want any part of what they had because they were very happy with the company they already had. You've all heard that you can't fix lazy, but you sure can numb it with an angle iron. In one case, the drive to perform was so strong that employees at a mill chased a lazy employee out of the plant with angle iron because he was not carrying his fair share of the load. Nucor tried to get the right people, and they treated them that way. When Nucor had a good year, everybody had a good year, so much so that one man's wife told him that if he ever got fired from Nucor, she would divorce him. Now, you know, we can see a few things in there that we would suggest some tweaks to. But the people were there for more than their paychecks. And something happened that they just brought an entirely different approach to their job. One of the other things that we value, and that I'm sure you value, is developing our people. As leaders, our most important job, and I see this increasingly in our business, that I see my most important job as being getting the right people together, giving them the training and the tools that they need, and getting out of their way. I'm going to excerpt a few things from the book. You don't need to be a title to be a leader. And I was thinking a little bit about, you know, a lot of what I think about is from a leadership perspective, from the owner or the manager, you know, somebody in leadership perspective, and what that looks like for how they lead. The fact of the matter is, many of us are not serving in leadership roles. And if marketplace mission is only possible for people in leadership roles, and that still leaves a lot of us who are just kind of stuck. And I want to talk a little bit more later about some of these things. But regardless where we are positionally in a business, we can see it and approach it as marketplace mission. Leadership isn't a title, it's influence. Regardless of our position, we lead people. We lead our children, we lead our coworkers, some of us lead our employers. You know, we influence many, many people. And you don't have to go any farther than a grade school playground to see these dynamics at work. My grandpa taught me, when working cattle, that it's important to let them have your way. And I think about that sometimes when I am, you know, I just want to kill the dumb things. I'm chasing them, running them ragged, and they don't go where I want to go. And, you know, it feels a little bit like we do that in a lot of life. It works profoundly better if a week before I want to move them, I set up my corrals and I start feeding them there. And I call them, and when I actually want to move them, I dump a little feed in the trough, I call them, and they come at a dead run. I stand out of their way and close the gate behind them. Now, we aren't trying to, you know, pen our employees up. but there's a profound difference between driving people and leading them where you would like for them to go. Zooming out a little bit, I'd like to talk about some of the core principles of business as mission. And I already mentioned that these applications look different for everybody in every different industry. One of the things that I think is constant is that eternity future begins in eternity present. So, you know, if you're going to impact things in the future, if your obituary is going to say what you want it to say, if your legacy continues long after we're gone, starting now is a really good place is a really good time to start. I have a book on my shelf. The title is "You Want Me to Do What?" The subtitle is "Get Off Your Blessed Assurance and Do Something." The most important step to take in making your work count is the first one. It is far easier to redirect a moving object than it is to start something moving. Whoever or wherever you are, make it count. You can always change later if God calls you differently. Another thing that I think is constant, regardless of our industry, use widely what has been entrusted to you. If you're an employee that doesn't care about the business because you're underappreciated and underpaid, you will probably never move into a different position. If you're the newest hire, if you are the face of the organization that you represent, you may make or keep a customer and contribute to making or keeping or losing your job, depending on how the impression you make on a customer comes across. And I have tons of stories about both good and bad illustrations of that. I think something we absolutely have to do as Christian business people in Marketplace Mission is we value people for more than their contribution to the bottom line. And in all of our businesses, we have clients, we have vendors, some of us have employees. If we only care for people, about people, for their contribution to the bottom line, you know, I hate to break it to you, but they're probably going to catch on, and they probably aren't going to like it much. I think in whatever business we're in, we should make profit with purpose. And this is, we could talk about this for forever. We all have a why behind our what. Why do you get up when the alarm rings in the morning? Why are you nice to an angry customer when you really want to yell at them? Why do you approach your sales and purchasing decisions the way you do? We all do these things, and we all have our particular way of handling them. I think it is important to understand a little bit about why you see things the way you do. Marketplace Mission allows us to interact with people we wouldn't otherwise interact with. I think it is crucial that we use and cherish that opportunity. And I just want to talk to you a little bit about some of the people that I get to interact with. And I was sitting at my desk this morning preparing for this, and I was just taking this cross-section of people that I interact with. I just kind of shook my head and I said, what on earth am I doing here? Because, you know, I work with some kind of strange people, and they're all different, and you know, it's good. One of my competitors in the Hutchinson property management market is about a 50-year-old happily married lesbian. Of the property managers that I relate to in Hutch, we probably share more similar management values than anybody else, and about once a month, we get together and learn from each other. As a property manager, I get to walk with people through financial difficulties. And you know, it can be pretty simple. You pay your rent or you leave. You know, that's the approach a lot of people bring. But we get to walk with people through financial difficulties and help them learn and take responsibility while helping them grow beyond what they have always known as normal despair. And I want to talk to you about two specific tenants that I have. One is sitting in jail in the custody of federal marshals because she was involved in an interstate drug trafficking ring. And she got picked up in October, and there was a big story in the paper, yada, yada, yada. And so I called her into the office, and I sat her down, and I said, you know, this doesn't make me very happy. What are we going to do about this? We have several ways that we can approach this. One is, you know, if you're happy with where you are, I can say, I'm not happy, you know, serve notice that if this continues, if it happens again, you know, we'll do something different. Or if you're not happy where you are, then we are here to try to help you get on top of stuff. And we have connections and people that we can refer you to that will help you do that. She looked at me and she said immediately, I hate my life. And I think she meant it with every ounce of her being. But she didn't follow up with the counseling appointment that I had set up for her. She never called. And, you know, that kind of irritated me. And I couldn't quite figure this out because she said she hated her life. I believe it. But she didn't do anything about it. About a month later, things came into a little more clarity when her mother called me and said that she had been picked up by federal marshals on charges for which she had been arrested about a year before but never been charged. They wanted her. They arrested her and wanted her to talk about other people she worked with. And she said, that's a really good way to get killed. I'm not saying anything. I think she absolutely hated where she was. And she absolutely knew that if she tried to change, that she probably would get killed for it. And, you know, that's an awkward position to be in. And it doesn't have a happy ending. But we get to walk with people through some of those situations. And I think being in the marketplace allows us to interact with these people in situations that we never would have otherwise. Some other of my tenants recently got arrested for a pretty brutal aggravated robbery. And they're sitting in jail, and I don't know what's happening, you know, with their court cases. And they're moving out of the house. You know, again, not a lot of happy endings. I wouldn't interact with most of these people if I would not be doing what we're doing. You know, so I think about some of those interactions. Then on the other end of the spectrum, we have an investor who is one of the top 100 trial lawyers in the United States, specializing in personal injury law and litigation, which is not a field of expertise I have typically idealized. And, you know, you talk about people at completely opposite ends of the spectrum, and we're in the middle, and we get to work with both of them. And it's a pretty neat place to be. If we were not in the marketplace and offering value to our clients, both investors and tenants, I would never have the opportunity to interact with this range of people. That's about all I have. Do you have any questions or comments about anything? I guess you can save your kind rebuttals for later. Do you have anything more? To close this out, why don't we stand and pray together the Lord's Prayer and think about some of the different things that are talked about here in terms of dependence, just think about it as we pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. Thank you. You're dismissed.